at the ward, creating a line of sparks. I frowned, pressing my hand to the surface. It gave almost like rubber. For a while it had been firm again, but now it was getting worse and fast. Agrippa had brushed it off when I'd mentioned it, but I continued to worry. We shouldn't be so harsh. I think he has a great deal on his mind. Since our discussion in the library, my relationship with Blackwood had improved. The angry, hateful thoughts I'd had about him now made me uncomfortable. There's his brooding lesson at dawn, followed by instructional despair at tea time. Magnus walked backward to look me in the face. I didn't imagine you'd be so masochistic as to like someone who dismissed your lowly birth. Don't say it out loud. Really, I told Magnus too much these days. He looked about, dramatically. No one nearby. Though perhaps we should turn back. Our shift is near done. We turned and started walking the way we'd come. All incumbents took turns patrolling the ward as part of the training. It had been 3 weeks since my triumph before Agrippa, and I was now allowed to participate in all areas of incumbent life. Before, it would have been unthinkable for me to go about with Magnus unchaperoned in the middle of the night. That no one objected proved that people had begun to take my abilities seriously. Perhaps I was finally stepping out of Gwendolyn Agrippa's shadow. I wouldn't blame you for getting a bit soft, of course. Blackwood is the Earl of Sorrowfell. Most girls would give their eye teeth to claim that prize. I groaned, the only appropriate response to such an idea. Don't be ridiculous. I'm here to be commended, not to catch a husband.
But it would be so nice to check both off your list at once, wouldn't it?
First of all, I wouldn't marry Lord Blackwood if he were the Prince of Plenty. I don't dislike him any more, but that's hardly a love written in the stars.
Very nice. What's the second of all?
I'll never marry. No man could want me in battle, and I wouldn't want anyone who might keep me away from my duty.
Don't be so hasty to rule out gentlemen's understanding, Magnus said. There are some who admire a capable girl. One of them might be closer than you think, if you'd take the time to notice what's before you.
He leaned closer. For a second, I didn't dare breathe. Since our moment in the library, Magnus had returned to his old, harmless flirtation. I'd half hoped it would stay that way. He sighed gently and said,
"Can't you see the way Palehook looks at you?"
He laughed. I was so relieved that I joined him.
So, who should I marry?
Someone confident, charming, insanely handsome, brilliant, who dances well and who can order the correct wine with any dish. Also, make sure he owns a horse. There's no use marrying if you don't have a horse. You'll have to travel to your honeymoon on the back of a turnip cart. He sheathed his stave. Enough marriage talk. What say we pop round the coffee stalls at Covent Garden?
Before I could respond, a scream pierced the darkness. We pressed our hands against the invisible wall to peer into the streets. After a minute, the scream came again, high and wailing. It sounded like a little girl. Magnus sliced through the barrier without a moment's pause. I grabbed his shoulder. "We need to wait for the others."
"It could be too late if we do."
He stepped through and ran in the direction of the cry. Idiot. Well, he was going nowhere without me. I shot 3 streams of fire into the air and waited until I heard the watch bell toll. Someone would come. Satisfied, I followed Magnus. He disappeared. My echoing footsteps were a lonely sound as I ran along the empty street. I began to think this was a bad plan. Then the child screamed again. Down an alley to the left, I found the little girl, pale, thin, ragged, and all alone. I crouched beside her.
"Are you all right? Where's your mother?"
She shook her head. I noticed that her right fist was clenched. When I opened it, I found myself staring at a bright new guinea.
How on earth did she have so much money?
Sorry about this,
the little girl whispered. With that, she turned and ran. Something struck me on the back of the head. Porridge rolled away from me as I fell forward and skinned my palms on the ground. Hands grabbed me by the hair, pulling me to my feet. Black figures loomed. Someone kicked me in the stomach. My breath left me in a rush, the pain so intense I crumpled into a ball. Struggling pathetically to breathe, I heard them mutter to one another.
Peggy, quick! Not yet! Bloody her up a bit first!
The voices, they were horribly familiar. As I unfolded myself, a boot struck me in the side. Sparks and stars danced on the edges of my sight. Bile flooded the back of my throat. I swung wildly, blindly, trying to fend them off.
Where's the knife?
A startled third voice.
What? We're not going to kill her, are we?
I knew that voice. Hands reached for me. Flames rippled over my body. A boy screamed as I crawled forward on my stomach, still burning, daring someone to touch me again. There was a cacophony of footsteps, racing toward and running from me. In my confusion, it seemed that footsteps pounded along the walls. Somewhere, Magnus shouted, "You filthy bastard!" Now I caught the sounds of struggle, of men at each other's throats. My vision seesawed from one bizarre angle to the next as Magnus threw someone to the ground. Sitting up, I found an unconscious Lovett sprawled beside me. There was a cut across his forehead, bleeding fresh.
"Bastard!"
I gasped, my voice a strange wheeze. I clawed at him, shook him, but he didn't wake up. Above, Magnus struggled with someone else. I expected to see Hemphill as I turned my head. Cellini hung in Magnus's grasp, a smear of blood beneath his nose. Something fell out of his hand and clattered across the ground. A knife. My stomach rippling, I fell to my hands, heaved, and vomited. My head throbbed. Cellini couldn't be here. He couldn't have attacked me. He was my friend. He was one of us.
Why?
I moaned. Cellini breathed heavily while Magnus held him by the collar, dumbfounded.
I don't understand.
Magnus's voice was small. Cellini began to cry.
It had to be done. Don't you see?
Give me some excuse.
Magnus's voice was pleading.
You don't really want to hurt her. They forced you.
Cellini's normally handsome face twisted in rage.
You choose her over us, over your own kind. Can't you see how freakish she is? Or are you always this soppy once you get them on their backs?
It was like he'd kicked me again. Magnus punched him. There was a gurgling cry, and Cellini spit blood onto the ground. One white tooth lay gleaming in the gore. Undeterred, Magnus continued the vicious beating, all traces of his humor gone. I hadn't thought him capable of such fury. Cellini's face began to resemble a slab of bloody meat. Crawling to my knees, I grabbed Magnus's arm.
Stop! I gasped. Let the order deal with him.
Where's the other one? Magnus cried. There were three of you. It was Hemphill, wasn't it? Cellini couldn't answer. He'd been knocked unconscious. When Magnus released him, he collapsed to the ground.
Do you know what he was going to do?
Magnus growled. He picked up the knife, blade gleaming in the moonlight, and tossed it away with a hiss of disgust.
Are you all right?
He helped me up off the ground and held me close.
I'm fine.
I leaned into his embrace and felt him trembling. We paced outside the library, listening to the muffled voices within. Once or twice, someone shouted, and then the murmuring returned. Magnus glared at the door, as if he could bore a hole through it with the strength of his will alone.
"Thank you," I said. "I'm not sure I could have kept them off on my own."
"If it were up to me, they'd hang the pair of them." Magnus hadn't changed out of his bloody, torn clothes. His hair stuck wildly in the air, and part of me wanted to pat it down. "I can't believe they let Hemphill go.
I can't be certain he was there. What will happen now?"
"Excommunication. They'll bind Lovett's stave, and he'll lose his position as heir to his father's estate. Cellini will be shipped back to Rome to face their brand of justice."
"Bind his stave?"
I knew that excommunicates were sorcerer outcasts but didn't know the details. "They dip the stave in molten lead to bind its power and sever its connection. Sometimes the sorcerer doesn't survive." He looked pale. "There are those who consider execution a more humane punishment." The idea wrenched my heart. I touched porridge in its sheath for comfort.
"Even if Cellini hated me, why risk so much?"
Magnus shook his head. "I don't know." I looked at my hands.
"I know he was your friend. This can't be easy."
"It's easier than you think, Hal. I could never let anyone hurt you."
My hands prickled with energy. There was no time to discuss it further. Palehook opened the door, a rumpled, tear-stained Lovett by his side.
"Miss Howell, I shall endeavour to see that every bit of justice is done. You've my word on that."
I noticed that Palehook didn't quite look me in the eye while speaking, and he pulled Lovett away as soon as he was able. Agrippa exited next, his face pale. He took my chin in his hand.
"Are you all right, my poor brave girl?"
He looked me over, tilting my head this way and that.
"You'll have a few bruises, but I think that's the worst of it. Go upstairs and let Fenswick look at you."
"I want to see him."
I gazed toward the library door. "No, I can't allow that."
"If you stay, Master, and I'm beside her, he won't try anything," Magnus said. He looked as if he'd adore one small excuse for another beating. "Please, I won't feel well unless I've seen him."
I didn't need more opportunities for nightmares.
The door creaked open, and Cellini slunk into the hall. His face was swollen, both from the bruises and from crying. "Why did you do it?" I said.
"I didn't think they planned murder. We just wanted you to leave."
When he spoke, I saw the hole where his front tooth had been. He wept. No sight had ever made me sicker. "You should have wanted to help me. Since I'm the prophesied."
"Oh, enough of that stupid tapestry!"
His tears vanished. His anger startled me.
"I held my tongue because English ways are not our ways. If you believed you could find salvation in a girl sorcerer, who was I to disagree?"
He sniffed and wiped his nose.
"At first you were all right, Miss Howell, but now you're dreadful."
When Magnus started for Cellini, I put my hand on his arm to hold him back. Cellini noticed, and his fury grew.
"Look at that, ordering men about. The trouble is, English sorcerers don't study their Bible. Paul's first epistle to Timothy. Let a woman learn quietly, with all submissiveness. I do not permit a woman to teach or to exercise authority over a man. In Rome, Women aren't even allowed inside an obsidian room. He looked to Agrippa and Magnus. She's not one of us. She'll destroy everyone if you let her. And it's only lucky I won't be here to see it. Magnus grabbed Cellini and lifted him off the ground by his collar. Agrippa stepped in at once to separate them. She's not one of us. Cellini and I had always gotten along, or so I thought. We played charades on the same team together, laughed over breakfast. How could I not have seen this anger? Had I really done something to deserve it? Or had I simply been proud? I remembered his anger when I'd flicked that little bit of fire at him, laughed at him. Perhaps arrogance in a woman was unbearable. I tried to find some apology in his eyes. There was only fury.
Give me your stave, Agrippa said.
As if it were torture, Cellini undid his hip sheath and handed it over. Part of me hurt for him, but the colder, angrier part won out.
I will be commended, I said,
my voice shaking despite my best efforts.
You can do nothing about that.
Someone will, he muttered.
I had to wonder, as they escorted Cellini off and I wiped my eyes, if someone else would attack. Even with my progress, I knew he was right. In a woman, pride was unforgivable.
Take 3 drops of this in a glass of water, Fenswick grumped, handing me a vial of bubbling golden liquid that changed to pink when I turned it upside down. He flapped his ears as I helped him off the bed. Anything else troubling you?
I still have nightmares.
The Rehlam dreams hadn't come to me as much since I'd gained control of my powers, but they did return.
Well, keep chewing willow bark,
he waddled to the door, when a housemaid entered with a tray for me. She wrinkled her nose at Fenswick and walked straight into him, bowling him over. He got to his feet, dusting himself off.
Be more careful, he snapped.
She set down the tray and swatted at him with a napkin.
Disgusting little thing. Shoo, she said,
driving a hissing Fenswick from the room. I sat up.
Don't you dare treat him like that, I cried.
The maid scowled. Why was tonight Lily's evening off?
Beg your pardon, miss, but it don't hurt him none. They don't feel things as we do.
He's a person, I said.
No, he ain't, miss, if you'll pardon me, she sniffed. He's a beast.
Once I might have agreed with her. Now, as she handed me my tray, all I could hear were Cellini's hissed words. She's not one of us. After lessons the next day, I took to the library to read about hobgoblins. We didn't have many volumes, but I found one passage in A Compendium of Faery, Lawrence Puckner, 1798, that said, A mandrake root or mouldy onion can be most instrumental in welcoming a subject of the Dark Fae Queen into a home. Agrippa's kitchen didn't contain a single mandrake root, however, I found an old onion with green bits sprouting on it. This would have to do. I took myself to Fenswick's corner of the house. He lived inside a chest of drawers in an empty servant's room. I found him relaxed in the bottommost drawer, his ears tucked behind him as he attempted a doze.
What is it? He said. Can't you let me rest?
He rubbed his eyes with 2 of his 4 paws.
I wanted to give you this.
I handed over the onion. He took it like he'd never seen one before in his life. I thought it might make you feel more at home.
For a moment, his expression didn't change. This had been a grave mistake. Then, his ears parted to the side. His black eyes glistened. He hugged the onion to his chest, sniffled and said,
I've been in this house 6 months, and no one's welcomed me yet.
I'd no idea how a sprouty onion made one feel wanted, but there were many things I didn't understand. I'm glad to have been the first.
Why do you care?
His ears perked up. I suppose I know what it's like to not quite belong.
You're a lady sorcerer.
With the marks to prove it. Touching a finger to a purplish bruise on my cheek, I made to leave.
Wait. The willow bark doesn't help with your bad dreams, does it?
Fenswick's ears slid down his back. Not much. Later that night, I found a packet in a velvet pouch outside my door. It smelled of herbs and rose hips. A note in a chubby, childish hand read,
For nightmares, place under pillow.
From that night forward, I didn't see Relam. He wasn't missed. Chapter 19. My new boy's clothes were a terrible fit. I had to roll the sleeves 3 times and tie a rope around my waist to hoist up the trousers, but racing across London rooftops was a job unsuitable for frocks. I lay on my belly and crawled forward. Hargrove pointed to the roof opposite us.
Let's see if you can place it. There, he said, indicating the chimney stack.
Careful to avoid tumbling, I pointed porridge at my heart, twisted the stave while muttering a few key nonsense words, and then flung my arm toward the other rooftop. It worked. A vision of myself, a complete copy of my current trousered state, gazed back at me from the chimney's base. It was startling to see myself outside a mirror. My copy's mouth hung wide open, like mine. I lost my balance and slipped toward the roof's edge. Hargrove pulled me back by the collar of my coat, and the vision opposite us disappeared.
Don't be a bloody fool, girl. No need to go tipping your balance over a good reflection. Now, I want to see you fly. Due south, aim for the edge of the wall. By the docks, where we had that pork pie last time.
With that, Hargrove swept his cloak around his body and floated into the sky. I'd be damned if he beat me. The last time I lost a race, I had to buy him a bottle of gin and massage his temples. Summoning the wind, I took off across the rooftops and above the labyrinthine alleyways of London. How marvellous it was to have a bird's eye view of the evening goings-on and lamp lightings. I was glad to be able to stay this long. Agrippa had gone to Surrey overnight on business for the order, and no one else felt the need to check on my whereabouts. I arrived at the meeting place and dropped gracefully to the ground. I heard a rush of wind and turned to welcome Hargrove down from the sky. But it wasn't his face that greeted me. It was hers. She fell to the earth, lacking the company of her terrifying friends. The Shadow Rider dismounted from her monstrous black stag, and even before she unrolled her smoke hood, I knew she would be the one with sewn-up eyes. She was no dream or illusion this time. The girl unsheathed her dagger and swung toward the screaming crowd. Men dropped their wares and ran. Women scuttled inside their houses and slammed the doors. I prepared to open fire when she whirled away from the people. Sniffing the air, she turned to face me.
Not dressed properly, she muttered to herself,
Tilting her head, she sniffed again, deeply.
But the same smell. And a stave.
Her face scrunched up, a momentary flash of pain.
Little Lady Sorcerer.
What are you doing here? I readied myself for an attack. The rider threw her head back and laughed.
Follow your scent. The Bloody King wants to know how you fight.
Ruhlam. She swung her dagger in the air twice, testing.
He wants to see if you'll die.
Leaping, she brought her blade in an arc toward me. I struck her with a gust of wind and rolled to the ground. I stood with my back against the ward as she drew herself up and hissed. This time, I fell aside as she attacked, and her dagger dug into the pale yellow outline of the barrier itself. The place of impact glowed bright green for an instant, then began to fade. She turned for me, nostrils flaring.
Good, good. Not afraid. He likes those with courage.
What does he want? I said. She struck again, and I met her with my warded blade. She was good, but Magnus's training had helped. We crossed swords a few times, and then I leaned back and kicked her in the stomach. You could accomplish so much in trousers and boots. Men didn't know how lucky they were. Before she could regain control, I blasted her with a tunnel of wind and twirled a spell that sent the earth up around her like a hand to catch and drag her down. She was chest deep next to the ward when Hargrove alighted beside me.
I've never seen that before,
he said, eyeing the trapped rider.
A blend of the two styles,
I muttered, as the girl shrieked and thrust her hands upward. It was as if she became smoke and bled through the earth to free herself. Hargrove and I unleashed a volley of magic. I called down the wind to dissipate the still smoke familiar, and he shrank her demonic steed to the size of a small dog. She reformed into her solid state and fell to the earth with a piercing screech. The rider stared stupidly at her dwarfed mount, which bleated like an angry lamb. Grabbing the stag under her arm, she held up a hand in a signal of surrender.
Leave!
I pointed Porridge with more confidence than I felt.
Or I'll fire!
Hissing, she reached out and touched the ward.
Soon!
She croaked, giving a small, hideous giggle as she slid her fingertips down the glowing surface. The stag ballooned back to its normal size, and she climbed atop it. They galloped into the sky and vanished before we could attack again.
We should go,
I whispered, tipping my cap over my eyes.
Indeed. After a hard day of protecting the city, I should think we'd earned a meat pie.
Hargrove didn't seem as carefree as his words implied. We looked to where the familiar had sliced the ward. When I put my fingers to it, I found the smallest cut in the surface.
Well,
he said as we landed on a rooftop to catch our breath.
Now you see the challenges of defeating one of the Shadow's pets. They always were the trickiest to destroy. The best familiars to kill, of course, are Molochorons. Slugs. You remember that fat, slimy fellow last week in Hoxton? The one we exploded?
What's happening to the ward? I whispered. It feels like rubber on the inside, and fragile glass without.
The ward usually wears down the closer we get to the solstice,
Hargrove said, cracking his back and wincing.
It's at its strongest around Christmas.
Why?
Some believe the ancients are tied to the pagan calendar, so Midsummer Eve is a particularly wonderful time for them. I think there's truth to it. Of course, the sorcerers use this concept to attack the witches. He sounded bitter.
Did you know any witches?
Before the burnings, you mean? Yes, one or two. He snorted and spit off the roof. A bunch of ladies with flowers and rye in their hair, farming and making potions to help with a toothache. Truly, the most fearsome magical practitioners of all.
If they're so innocent, why were they outlawed?
Many believe that magical women are difficult to control, Hargrove said, as you are well aware.
The memory of Cellini and the knife returned in vivid colour.
While we're talking, have you payment for another evening's lesson?
He snapped his fingers. Groaning, I dug into my pocket and produced 2 sovereigns. Handing them over, I muttered, "Try to spend it sensibly.
This makes 10 pounds and 4 shillings. Almost there. And the rest?
Next time."
Agrippa now gave me £2 a week for spending money, so he unwittingly paid for my lessons. That made approximately 5 weeks of sneaking off to visit Hargrove when I could. I swung my legs over the roof and looked to the ward, a glowing bubble in the night.
What happens if the barriers don't hold?
What do you think? Total pandemonium. Hopefully, when that happens, I'll be an ocean away.
What? Where are you going?
Surprisingly, the thought of losing him hurt. Hargrove had never been exactly warm, but he knew my secrets. That was something.
Where you're sending me with that £12, or to be more exact, £10 and 4 shillings. The rest of Europe won't take in a refugee from England, but America might.
You'll never get out to sea.
I know the right person, Hargrove said.
Who?
Then I recalled Magnus's mention of smuggler ships that charged money for a clandestine voyage.
Better if you're not privy to the whereabouts and who is its. All I need is the money, which I'm about to have in full.
You'll leave me? What are the children?
The commendation's in less than 2 weeks. You won't need me any more. I didn't say I wouldn't take the children, just that I'd only need 1 ticket.
Of course, he'd store them inside the magical trunk.
I'm not a total bastard, you know.
I thought you wanted to see magicians come back into power.
His face lost all traces of joviality.
I've sacrificed enough for this bloody cause. Let the young fight, if they've the will.
Did you train me to feel like you'd done your share?
I asked quietly.
Perhaps. I believe there was a debt I needed to acknowledge.
To whom?
I scooted back from the roof's edge and stood, dusting my trousers.
Not to anyone in particular, he said. Now I consider it paid. Because of you, he smiled. You're my last laugh. The sorcerers will honor an upstart magician's daughter as the answer to their precious prophecy.
He spit once again. Cinderella's wicked stepsisters had to walk behind the wedding party, sulking. The birds, who had seen all the cruelty in their hearts, flew out of the sky and plucked the sisters' eyes from their heads. I hissed at the children, bundled up for bed, and they gasped. But Cinderella, who had been good and true, ruled with her prince for many years. They sighed at this revelation. Charlie's little sister clung to my skirt and wouldn't let go. Gently, I took her into my arms and went to sit at the table with Hargrove. He looked pleased. And drunk.
"Taste of the spoils," he said, offering me the bottle.
I declined.
Where was I? Before you had to change your clothes and tend to these ragamuffins.
The little girl had already fallen asleep on my lap. I hugged her close. You were telling me of the magical schism.
Magician history was one topic I'd been interested to learn, and he to share. Ah, yes. You'll recall Henry VIII, great hairy king, who liked having things his own way. His first wife, Catherine, couldn't give him a son. So, he went to his order of royal sorcerers and said, "Find a way to let the queen conceive." No one knew how, of course, and told him he was being a crazy git. One of them, Ralph Strangeways, dreaming of fortune and fame, decided to see what he could do. For 2 months, Strangeways locked himself in his room. He ordered books of all sorts, alchemical, medical, biblical. One day, he summoned the king to his chambers and presented a woman. Some say he fashioned her hair from ribbons, her skin from candlelight, her body from the west wind, and her tongue from 3 notes of birdsong. But she was the most beautiful and the strangest woman anyone had ever seen. The king fell in love. Upon the instant, Strangeways said, "Here is the woman who will birth your new sovereign."
"Anne Boleyn," I said, certain he was playing me for a fool.
"Indeed." So, the king divorced Catherine and married this magical creation. For a while, Strangeways and magicians eclipsed sorcerers in every way. Of course, as history tells us, Boleyn got her head lopped off, and Strangeways fell out of favor. Ended up in the tower, waiting to see if anyone would have him executed. But when Queen Elizabeth came to power, that child of magic and royalty, she commended Strangeways. Magicians became, for her reign at least, the preferred magical practitioners. Elizabeth was a mule. Did you know that? Born not of human woman, but seeded by human man. Many believe the reason she was the Virgin Queen was because she had no means to procreate. He giggled until his dark skin flushed darker still. You know, down there, smooth as the wickless end of a candle. I shushed him, nodding at the child asleep on my knee. I think these are all lies. He made a rude noise and drank some more. You're a good apprentice.
Thank you.
Granted, you're as much fun as pig slop dressed up for a Friday night, but you can't have everything. He wheezed with laughter. You're so sour that if Molochoron swallowed you, the whole mass of him would pucker. He drummed his feet upon the ground and laughed like he'd die.
I know, I said. Tell me more of magician history.
No, you tell me your history, my little kipper. Why are you such a grim-faced melon?
Because I know what I am. I stared at my hands.
Which is?
As you've said yourself, unlovable. To my annoyance, Hargrove stuck out his tongue at me.
You young girls are all the same. Oh, my life is so impossible. No boy will ever desire me, and I'll live alone in a hovel with 16 cats. Such is my woe, he said it all in a piercing, effeminate voice.
I don't pity myself. I simply know that I'm not easily loved.
He stopped his mimicry.
What's so awful about you?
I'd never told this story to anyone before. Not even Rook. Unsure as to why I should relate this to Hargrove of all people, I said, When I was 5 years old, my Aunt Agnes brought me to my Yorkshire school. I could recall her vividly after all this time. A tall, proud woman in black clothes who wouldn't look at me as I clung to her skirt. I cried as she walked back toward her carriage. I yelled, Please, Auntie, don't leave me here. I want to go with you. I love you. That was when she turned to me and said, I stopped when a hitch formed in my throat.
What did she say?
Hargrove lost his smirk. You are a horrid child. If only you could be pleasant, I would love you. But how could anyone care for a peevish, whining, solemn little thing like you? The words were exact. I'd run them through my mind at least once every day since they were uttered. And there you have it, I said, my voice artificially bright, forcing a smile. Nothing to be done. I turned my face away as a tear crept down my cheek.
Poor child,
he said, his voice soft. He reached across the table, and I gave him my hand.
Poor, poor child.
In that moment, he sounded as tender as a gripper.
You have a good heart. It wasn't your fault.
Then he said, so quiet I nearly missed it.
It wasn't hers, either.
What? Hargrove released me. Placing his head in his hand, he said,
Please, use the porter's circle. I'm tired.
Did I offend you?
It's not enough that I have several little mouths to feed and you to teach. Now I have to be bogged down by these depressing stories.
Stung, I laid the little girl to sleep and went to the carved porter's circle. I didn't mean to ruin your night. Goodbye. I lifted my skirt to step inside.
Henrietta,
he rarely used my name.
You've suffered a great deal. Remember that you're not the only one.
He laid his head on the table as though he was exhausted. It was selfish of me to burden you, I muttered, and vanished toward home. The next night, I sat before the parlour fire with Blackwood. He used cards to test my memory on the ancients.
Zem, he said.
The firelight danced on his features, shadowing his eyes. A fire-breathing serpent, as long as a small ship. He's seen frequently in Hertfordshire, and has levelled, at present, 2 entire villages. I squeezed my eyes shut in concentration.
Good. What's being done in Hertfordshire to defend the citizenry?
All sorcerer families with estates in the area have sent at least one son as protection. They're also creating a series of canals in each village to bring in water as a natural deterrent to Zem. It's a slow process.
Excellent.
He laid down the cards.
How have you been these last 2 weeks?
There was concern in his eyes. Ever since Cellini's attack, Blackwood and the others had taken extra care of me. Lamb and Wolf showed me new strategies for chess. Dee tried especially hard not to step on my feet during dance practice. I'm all right.
Do you still need to be alone on your afternoons off?
Something about the way he said it took my attention.
You've become so skilled. Surely the entire afternoon's no longer necessary.
Is there something you'd like to ask?
Some are sure to be interested in what you do. I advise you to be careful. His tone and look suggested this was serious.
Who's interested?
Only try not to draw too much attention to yourself. He sank deeper into his armchair and shuffled his cards. I knew that look he wore. Try as I might, I would get nothing else out of him on the subject. Now then, tell me about Relum, and be sure to focus on his campaign in Scotland.
Chapter 20. Over the next 9 days, I avoided going to see Hargrove. I played games in the parlour, attended lessons, and took chaperoned cart rides with Magnus. I tried to convince myself that I didn't care if I ever saw the magician again. But I woke the morning of June 19th, feeling guilty. The commendation ball was in a mere 2 days, and I doubted I'd get a chance to visit after I became a sorcerer. Besides, he needed the last of the money. He'd earned it. One final lesson before we both moved on with our lives. When I arrived, we didn't speak for the first few minutes. I laid out a sack of oranges for the children, which they joyfully snatched up. He sat with his face cupped in his hand, drumming his fingers on the table. I gave him the last of the money and spent a great deal of time folding and refolding my gloves.
"You seem distant today," Hargrove said at last.
"If I am, I don't want to concern you," I replied. "It's rude to ask you to share my troubles."
"I'm sorry about the other night."
He ran a copper penny along his fingers, over and over again.
"Responding to such a story in such a way was the height of bad manners."
His apology shocked me. Surely the real magician had been kidnapped by fairies, and this polite copy left in his place.
"I have always been uncomfortable with fragile things, like feelings and confessions. Butterflies, too."
"I forgive you," I said, studying an orange. "Shall we have a lesson?"
"There's nothing more I can teach you." "No. I thought today we might talk."
The penny glided over his fingers at a faster pace. Hargrove wanted to talk. Why did he seem so nervous?
"Are you ready to be commended?"
"As I'll ever be," I said.
Hargrove didn't respond, only watched the children devour the oranges.
"What is it?"
"When you first came here, I thought you'd be just like your father. I was wrong."
He slammed the coin down on the table and rubbed his chin. He looked like someone preparing to dive into an icy river.
"In what way? You think I'm not as good a magician as he was?"
"Hardly. I think with more time, you could be a better one. William was a talented sort, but he had no real discipline. At least, not when I knew him."
He leaned back in his chair. "Is my being a sorcerer what's concerning you? I won't forget what you've taught me about where I come from. Maybe before you leave for America, I can return one last time."
"No. Once you're commended, you cannot return."
So this would be our final meeting. Sadness lumped in my stomach. Even though Hargrove could be gruff and smelled of cabbages and alcohol. "Thank you for everything," I said. "I'll do what I can to help the magician cause. I swear."
Wincing, he stood and turned his back to me.
"No, you're not like William," You have his same impulsive rashness. But you can be reasonable when you try. I think, he said, pausing as he turned to face me, that you could bear it.
Bear what?
Sometimes I believe that our lives are lived in an endless cycle, he said. That our error becomes our children's burden, and eventually that burden becomes their error, and so on. The only way out of it is to break the cycle. Do you understand?
No. I don't think I do.
He sat down and grasped my hand. There's something I need to tell you about your father. You see, he wasn't. There was a knock at the door, and Blackwood opened it without waiting for a reply. When he saw me, the color drained from his face. What are you doing here? He said. He half attempted to hide a small velvet pouch behind his back. Cheeks flushed and breathing deep, he looked as if he'd been running. Well? What on earth was he doing here? It wasn't Friday, his regular charity day. I wouldn't have come if it were. To add to my surprise, Rook appeared in the doorway with a parcel in his arms. Nettie, he said, shocked as Blackwood and I. We made a sort of trinity of bewilderment. Before I could speak, Blackwood took my arm. What are you doing? I said, stunned by his boldness. We're leaving, he snapped, tossing the velvet pouch to Hargrove. It landed with a jingle of coins. Charity, Blackwood mumbled. It's always appreciated, Hargrove said dryly, spilling the money onto the tabletop. Come back any time, miss. Tuppence for another tarot. Halfpenny to read your tea leaves, though you must bring your own kettle. I will walk on my own, thank you, I said, wrenching my arm out of Blackwood's grip. We tromped out of the room, Rook and me walking ahead of him. I was deliberately slow, just to be irritating. What are you doing here? Rook whispered. Paying a call. I stumbled over the words. I still wasn't comfortable with lying to him. Has he had you rushing about all day? Don't worry about me. He jerked his head in Blackwood's direction. I won't let him be rough with you. There's more danger of me being rough with him. Once below, I turned to Blackwood. You can't treat me that way in front of people. Why are you here? He sounded furious. I brought something for the children. Weren't you doing the same? Why would you visit a magician? If Master Agrippa knew... I'd be so grateful if you wouldn't tell him, I said, trying to sound as gentle and conciliatory as possible. He set off down the street, and I hurried to catch up. Perhaps I should, he said. Well, bother gentle and conciliatory. Master Agrippa's certain I'll be commended. Are you looking for an excuse to sabotage that? It was a childish thing to say, but I wanted to lob something at him. Do you really believe that? He shouted, stopping dead in the road. The crowd flowed around us. After I've told you about my responsibility toward the Order... After I've spent hours helping to train you. Haven't I warned you that people are curious about where you go? Yes, but you never told me who exactly was so curious. He huffed. I'm attempting to protect you. Because I'm a fragile lady. Because you're going to be a sorcerer, he yelled. I can't believe you'd come here alone after what happened with Cellini. He had a point. And visiting a magician is dangerous to your reputation. Magicians cannot be trusted. Why not? The urge to hit him increased tenfold. What do you mean, why not? No good can come from associating with... Where's Rook? I turned around to speak to him, but he was gone,
He's fine.
There was a wild, haunted look in Blackwood's eyes. He froze and stared with such intensity at the brick wall behind me that I wondered if he could see through it.
What is it? I touched his arm. Are you well?
Something's wrong. Please, stay here.
He turned and, without another word, pushed through the crowd. Mystified, I called his name as I ran after him. We returned to the alley just outside Hargrove's. That was when I saw them. Rook was locked in a struggle with two men dressed all in black. One of them had an arm around Rook's throat. He kicked out at the other attacker, striking him hard in the chest. In an instant, I'd readied a blade. Blackwood followed my example, and together we ran toward the fight. Rook's face twisted in terror.
"Nettie!"
he cried. At first I thought it was a call for help, but he put up his hand, a gesture intended to stop me.
"No!"
The darkness rushed in from the walls and the crevices. Rook and the two men disappeared behind a veil of shadow. Blackwood and I stood helpless before the void. I could see nothing, but I heard the men's terrified cries.
"What the devil?"
Blackwood breathed. I panicked. He couldn't know about Rook's powers, not yet. Hating myself, I collected my ward's invisible force and threw it at Blackwood. A great blast of energy knocked him against a wall, and he slid to the ground. Checking quickly, I found him unconscious but breathing. I prayed I hadn't truly hurt him, then ran toward the attackers. The covering of darkness pulsed before me. Inside, the men's voices began to fade. I reached out a hand to pierce the shadow, but drew back in fear. Something was different and awful about this blackness.
"Let them go!" I cried. "Can you hear me? Rook!"
I flung a layer of fire over the writhing mass. The shadow patch dissolved, revealing the three men lying on the ground. None of them moved. Rook was curled on his side.
"Rook, are you all right?"
Terrified, I knelt next to him. Rook lunged at me. His eyes gleamed black. There was nothing human in that look. He gripped my arms and threw me to the ground. My head struck the earth, and I grasped for porridge. If Rook attacked again, he'd face a spell. But the attack didn't come. I waited in fearful silence until I heard him whisper,
"Nettie, what did I do?"
Slowly, I got up and crawled around to face him. His eyes were their normal blue. His expression was one of horror.
"Did I touch you?"
The men on the ground drew my attention. One of them sobbed and shivered as though he were cold. The other lay flat on his back, staring blankly at the sky above.
"Get up,"
I said, trying to sound commanding. The crying fellow hastened to his feet, pointing at me in terror.
"Stay away,"
he yelled, and helped his companion stand. The quiet man moved as he was bid, but didn't seem terribly aware of his surroundings.
"What were you doing?"
I held up my blade, though I wasn't so forceful. We were all too terrified for shows of bravado.
"Stay away,"
the man cried again, and the two ran down the alley. Rook pulled me to the ground as I tried to go after them.
"Don't. It's what they want,"
Rook gasped, holding me back.
"But they attacked you."
"Wasn't me they were after. They grabbed me when they couldn't snatch their true mark. Anyone could see that."
"What?"
And then I realized that Rook had been walking with me. Cellini himself had said others would attack.
"Oh, God."
"I don't think they'll be back,"
Rook rubbed his eyes.
"I scared them off."
"Yes, thank you."
"No,"
he shuddered.
"I hurt you. How could I have done that?" You didn't know it was me. Exactly. We couldn't tell you from the others. Now, I was truly afraid.